mysteriously in the night. My sister's gift to me one Christmas was a set of magnetic tiles for the refrigerator in Ojibwe, or Anishinaabe Mon, a language closely related to Potawatomi. I spread them out on my kitchen table looking for familiar words, but the more I looked, the more worried I got. Among the 100 or more tiles, there was a single word that I recognized. Miigwech, thank you. The small feeling of accomplishment from months of study evaporated in a moment. I remember paging through the Ojibwe dictionary she sent, trying to decipher the tiles, but the spellings didn't always match, and the print was too small, and there are way too many variations on a single word, and I was feeling that this was just way too hard. The threads in my brain knotted, and the harder I tried, the tighter they became. Pages blurred, and my eyes settled on a word, a verb, of course, to be a Saturday. I threw down the book. Since when is Saturday a verb? Everybody knows it's a noun. I grabbed the dictionary and flipped more pages, and all kinds of things seemed to be verbs. To be a hill. To be red. To be a long, sandy stretch of beach. And then my finger rested on Wikwigama. To be a bay. Ridiculous, I ranted in my head. There's no reason to make it so complicated. No wonder no one speaks it. A cumbersome language, impossible to learn, and more than that, it's all wrong. A bay is most definitely a person, place, or thing, a noun and not a verb. I was ready to give up. I'd learned a few words, done my duty to the language that was taken from my grandfather. Oh, the ghosts of the missionaries in the boarding schools must have been rubbing their hands in glee at my frustration. She's going to surrender, they said. And then, I swear, I heard the zap of synapses firing. An electric current sizzled down my arm and through my finger and practically scorched the page where that one word lay. In that moment, I could smell the water of the bay, watch it rock against the shore, and hear it sift onto the sand. A bay is a noun, only if water is dead. When bay is a noun, it is defined by humans, trapped between its shores and contained by the word. But the verb, Wikwigama, to be a bay, releases the water from bondage and lets it live. To be a bay holds the wonder that for this moment the living water has decided to shelter itself between these shores, conversing with cedar roots and a flock of baby mergansers. Because it could do otherwise, become a stream or an ocean or a waterfall, and there are verbs for that too. To be a hill, to be a sandy beach, to be a Saturday. All are possible verbs in a world where everything is alive. Water, land, and even a day. The language a mirror for seeing the animacy of the world, the life that pulses through all things, through pines and nut hatches and mushrooms. This is the language I hear in the woods. This is the language that lets us speak of what wells up all around us. And the vestiges of boarding schools, those soap-wielding missionary wraiths, hang their heads in defeat. This is the grammar of animacy. Imagine seeing your grandmother stand at the stove in her apron and then saying of her, "Look, it is making soup. It has gray hair." We might snicker at such a mistake, but also recoil from it. In English, we never refer to a member of our family, or indeed to any person, as it. That would be a profound act of disrespect. It robs a person of selfhood and kinship, reducing a person to a mere thing. So it is that in Potawatomi and most other indigenous languages, we use the same words to address the living world as we do for our family, because they are our family. to whom does our language extend the grammar of animacy? Naturally, plants and animals are animate. But as I learn, I am discovering that the Potawatomi understanding of what it means to be animate diverges from the list of attributes of living beings we all learned in Biology 101. In Potawatomi 101, rocks are animate, as are mountains and water and fire and places. Beings that are imbued with spirit are sacred medicines, are songs, drums, and even stories are all animate. The list of the inanimate seems to be smaller, filled with objects that are made by people. Of an inanimate being, like a table, we say, what is it? And we answer, dopwin yewe, table it is. But of apple, we must say, who is that being? And reply, mishimin yahweh, apple that being is. Yahweh, the animate to be, I am, you are, she, he is. To speak of those possessed with life and spirit, we must say Yahweh. By what linguistic confluence do Yahweh of the Old Testament and Yahweh of the New World both fall from the mouths of the reverent? Isn't this just what it means? To be, to have the breath of life within, to be the offspring of creation. The language reminds us in every sentence of our kinship with all of the animate world. English doesn't give us many tools for incorporating respect for animacy. In English, you are either a human or a thing. Our grammar boxes us in by the choice of reducing a non-human being to an it, or it must be gendered, inappropriately, as a he or a she. Where are our words for the simple existence of another living being? Where is our Yahweh? My friend Michael Nelson, an ethicist who thinks a great deal about moral inclusion, told me about a woman he knows, a field biologist whose work is among other than humans. Most of her companions are not two-legged, so her language has shifted to accommodate her relationships. She kneels along the trail to inspect a set of moose tracks, saying, "Someone's already been this way this morning." "Someone is in my hat," she says, shaking out a deer fly. Someone, not something. When I am in the woods with my students, teaching them the gifts of plants and how to call them by name, I try to be mindful of my language, to be bilingual between the lexicon of science and the grammar of animacy. Although they still have to learn scientific roles and Latin names, I hope I am also teaching them to know the world as a neighborhood of non-human residents, to know that, as eco-theologian Thomas Berry has written, we must say of the universe that it is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. One afternoon, I sat with my field ecology students by a Wikwagama and shared this idea of animate language. One young man, Andy, splashing his feet in the clear water, asked the big question. "Wait a second," he said, as he wrapped his mind around this linguistic distinction. "Doesn't that mean that speaking English, thinking in English, somehow gives us permission to disrespect nature by denying everyone else the right to be persons? Wouldn't things be different if nothing was an it?" Swept away with the idea, he said it felt like an awakening to him. More like a remembering, I think. The animacy of the world is something we already know, but the language of animacy teeters on extinction, not just for native peoples, but for everyone. Our toddlers speak of plants and animals as if they were people, extending to them self and intention and compassion, until we teach them not to. We quickly retrain them and make them forget. When we tell them that the tree is not a who, but an it, we make that maple an object. we put a barrier between us, absolving ourselves of moral responsibility and opening the door to exploitation. Saying it makes a living land into natural resources. If Maple is an it, we can take up the chainsaw. If Maple is her, we think twice. Another student countered Andy's argument, but we can't say he or she. That would be anthropomorphism. They are well-schooled biologists who have been instructed in no uncertain terms never to ascribe human characters to a study object, to another species. It's a cardinal sin that leads to a loss of objectivity. Carla pointed out that it's also disrespectful to the animals. We shouldn't project our perceptions onto them. They have their own ways. They're not just people in furry costumes. Andy countered, but just because we don't think of them as humans doesn't mean they aren't beings. Isn't it even more disrespectful to assume that we're the only species that count as persons? The arrogance of English is that the only way to be animate, to be worthy of respect and moral concern, is to be human. A language teacher I know explained that grammar is just the way we chart relationships in language. Perhaps it also reflects our relationships with each other. Maybe a grammar of animacy could lead us to a whole new way of living in the world, other species as sovereign people, a world with a democracy of species, not a tyranny of one, with moral responsibility to water and wolves, and with a legal system that recognizes the standing of other species. It's all in the pronouns. Andy is right. Learning the grammar of animacy could well be a restraint on our mindless exploitation of land. But there's more to it. I have heard our elders give advice like, you should go among the standing people, or go spend some time with those beaver people. They remind us that the capacity of others as our teachers, as holders of knowledge, as guides. Imagine walking through a richly inhabited world of birch people, bear people, rock people, beings we think of and therefore speak of as persons worthy of our respect, of inclusion in a peopled world. We Americans are reluctant to learn a foreign language of our own species, let alone another species. But imagine the possibilities. Imagine the access we would have to different perspectives, the things we might see through other eyes, the wisdom that surrounds us. We don't have to figure out everything by ourselves. There are intelligences other than our own, teachers all around us. Imagine how much less lonely the world would be. Every word I learn comes with a breath of gratitude for our elders who have kept this language alive and passed along its poetry. I still struggle mightily with verbs, can hardly speak at all, and I'm still most adept with only kindergarten vocabulary. But I like that in the morning I can go for my walk around the meadow greeting neighbors by name. When crow caws at me from the hedgerow, I can call back, "Mano gizget under shukwe." I can brush my hand over the soft grasses and murmur, "Bonjour, Mishkos." It's a small thing, but it makes me happy. I'm not advocating that we all learn Potawatomi or Hopi or Seminole, even if we could. Immigrants came to these shores bearing a legacy of languages, all to be cherished. But to become native to this place, if we are to survive here, and our neighbors too, our work is to learn to speak the grammar of animacy so that we might truly be at home. I remember the words of Bill Tallbull, a Cheyenne elder. As a young person, I spoke to him with a heavy heart, lamenting that I had no native language with which to speak to the plants and the places that I love. "They love to hear the old language," he said. "It's true." But he said with fingers on his lips, "You don't have to speak it here." "If you speak it here," he said, patting his chest. They will hear you. Tending sweetgrass. Wild meadow sweetgrass grows long and fragrant when it is looked after by humans. Weeding and care for the habitat and neighboring plants strengthens its growth. Maple sugar moon. When Nana Bojo, the Anishinaabe original man, our teacher, part man, part Monado, walked through the world, he took note of who was flourishing and who was not, of who was mindful of the original instructions and who was not. He was dismayed when he came upon villages where the gardens were not being tended, where the fishnets were not repaired, and the children were not being taught the way to live. Instead of seeing piles of firewood and caches of corn, he found the people lying beneath maple trees, with their mouths wide open, catching the thick, sweet syrup of the generous trees. They had become lazy and took for granted the gifts of the Creator. They did not do their ceremonies or care for one another. He knew his responsibility, so he went to the river and dipped up many buckets of water. He poured the water straight into the maple trees to dilute the syrup. Today, maple sap flows like a stream of water with only a trace of sweetness to remind the people both of possibility and of responsibility. And so it is that it takes 40 gallons of sap to make a gallon of syrup. Plink! On an afternoon in March, when the late winter sun is starting to strengthen and moving north a degree or so each day, the sap runs strong. Plink! The yard of our old farmhouse in Fabius, New York, is graced with 7 maples, big ones, planted almost 200 years ago to shade the house. The largest tree is as wide at its base as our picnic table is long. When we first moved here, my daughters reveled in rooting through the loft above the old stable, a space full of the flotsam of almost 2 centuries of families before us. One day I found them playing with an entire village of little metal pup tents set up under the trees. They're going camping, they said, of their various dolls and stuffed animals who were peeking out from under their shelter. The loft was full of such tents that fit over old-time sap buckets to keep out the rain and snow during sugaring season. When the girls discovered what these little tents were for, of course they wanted to make maple syrup. We scrubbed out the mouse droppings and readied the buckets for spring. During that first winter, I read up on the whole process. We had buckets and covers, but no spiles, the spouts you need to drive into the tree to allow the sap out. But we live in Maple Nation, and a nearby hardware store carried all things maple sugaring. All things. Molds for forming maple sugar leaves, evaporators of every size, miles of rubber tubing, hydrometers, kettles, filters, and jars, none of which I could afford. But tucked away in the back, they had old-fashioned spiles, which hardly anyone wants anymore. I got a whole box for 75 cents each. Sugaring has changed over the years. Gone are the days of emptying buckets and sledging barrels of sap through the snowy woods. In many sugaring operations, plastic tubing runs right from the trees to the sugar house. But there are still purists out there who cherish the plink of sap into a metal bucket, and that requires a spile. One end is formed into a tube like a drinking straw, which you tap into a hole drilled in the tree. The tube then opens into a trough about 4 inches long, and at the base there is a handy hook on which to hang the bucket. I bought a big, clean garbage can to store the sap, and we were ready. I didn't think we'd need all that storage space, but better to be prepared. In a climate where winter lasts 6 months, we always search assiduously for signs of spring, but never more eagerly than after we decided to make syrup. The girls ask every day, "Can we start yet?" But our beginning was entirely determined by the season. For the sap to run, you need a combination of warm days and freezing nights. Warm is a relative term, of course, 35 to 42 degrees, so that the sun thaws the trunk and starts the flow of sap inside. We watch the calendar and the thermometer And Larkin asks, "How do the trees know it's time if they can't see the thermometer?" Indeed, how does a being without eyes or nose or nerves of any kind know what to do and when to do it? There are not even leaves out to detect the sun. Every bit of the tree, except the buds, is swathed in thick, dead bark. And yet the trees are not fooled by a midwinter thaw. The fact is, maples have a far more sophisticated system for detecting spring than we do. There are photosensors by the hundreds in every single bud, packed with light-absorbing pigments called phytochromes. Their job is to take the measure of light every day. Tightly furled, covered in red-brown scales, each bud holds an embryonic copy of a maple branch, and each bud wants desperately to someday be a full-fledged branch, leaves rustling in the wind and soaking up sun. But if the buds come out too soon, they'll be killed by freezing. Too late, and they'll miss the spring. So the buds keep the calendar. But those baby buds need energy for their growth into branches. Like all newborns, they are hungry. We who lack such sophisticated sensors look for other signs. When hollows appear in the snow around the tree bases, I start to think it's tapping time. The dark bark absorbs the growing heat of the sun and then radiates it back to slowly melt the snow that has lain there all winter. When those circles of bare ground appear, that's when the first drops of sap will plop onto your head from a broken branch in the canopy. And so with drill in hand, we circle our trees, searching out just the right spot, 3 feet up, on a smooth face. Lo and behold, there are scars of past taps, long healed over, made by whoever had left those sap buckets in our loft. We don't know their names or their faces, but our fingers rest right where theirs had been. And we know what they too were doing one morning in April long ago. And we know what they had on their pancakes. Our stories are linked in this run of sap. Our trees knew them as they know us today. The spiles begin to drip almost as soon as we tap them into place. The first drops splat onto the bottom of the bucket. The girls slide the tented covers on, which make the sound echo even more. Trees of this diameter could accept 6 taps without damage, but we don't want to be greedy and only place 3. By the time we're done setting them up, the first bucket is already singing a different tune, the plink of another drop into the half inch of sap. All day long they change pitch as the buckets fill, like water glasses of different pitch. Plink, ploink, plunk. The tin buckets in their tented tops reverberate with every drop, and the yard is singing. This is spring music as surely as the cardinal's insistent whistle. My girls watch in fascination. Each drop is as clear as water, but somehow thicker, catching the light and hanging for a second at the end of the spile, growing invitingly into a larger and larger drop. The girls stretch out their tongues and slurp with a look of bliss, and unaccountably I am moved to tears. It reminds me of when I alone fed them. Now, on sturdy young legs, they are nursed by a maple, as close as they can come to being suckled by Mother Earth. All day long the buckets fill, and by evening they are brimming. The girls and I haul all 21 to the big garbage can and pour until it is almost full. I had no idea there would be so much. The girls rehang the buckets while I build the fire. Our evaporator is just my old canning kettle set on an oven rack, spanning stacks of cinder blocks scavenged from the barn. It takes a long time to heat up a kettle of sap, and the girls lose interest pretty quickly. I am in and out of the house, keeping fires going in both places. When I tuck them into bed that night, they are full of anticipation of syrup by morning. I set up a lawn chair on the packed-down snow next to the fire, feeding it constantly to keep up a good boil in the now freezing night. Steam billows from the pot, covering and uncovering the moon and the dry, cold sky. I taste the sap as it boils down, and with every passing hour it is discernibly sweeter, but the yield from this 4-gallon kettle will be nothing more than a skin of syrup on the bottom of the pan, scarcely enough for one pancake. So as it boils down, I add more fresh sap from the garbage can, hoping to have just one cup of syrup by morning. I add wood, then wrap myself back in blankets, dozing until I can add more logs or sap. I don't know what time I woke up, but I was cold and stiff in my lawn chair, and the fire was burnt to embers, leaving the sap lukewarm. Beaten, I went inside to bed. When I returned in the morning, I found the sap in the garbage can frozen hard. As I got the fire going again, I remembered something I had heard about how our ancestors made maple sugar. The ice on the surface was pure water, so I cracked it and threw it on the ground like a broken window. People of the Maple Nation made sugar long before they possessed trade kettles for boiling. Instead, they collected sap in birch bark pails and poured it into long troughs hollowed from basswood trees. The large surface area and shallow depth of the troughs was ideal for ice formation. Every morning, ice was removed, leaving a more concentrated sugar solution behind. The concentrated solution could then be boiled to sugar with far less energy required. The freezing nights did the work of many cords of firewood, a reminder of elegant connections. Maple sap runs at the one time of year when this method is possible. Wooden evaporating dishes were placed on flat stones over the coals of a fire that burned night and day. In the old times, families would all move together to sugar camp, where firewood and equipment had been stored the year before. Grandmothers and the youngest babies would be pulled on toboggans through the softening snow so that all could attend to the process. It took all the knowledge and all the arms to make sugar. Most of the time was spent stirring. Good storytelling time, when folks from the dispersed winter camps came together. But there were also pulses of furious activity. When the syrup reached just the right consistency, it was beaten so that it would solidify it in the desired way, into soft cakes, hard candy, and granulated sugar. The women stored it in birch bark boxes called macaques, sewn tight with spruce root. Given birch bark's natural antifungal preservatives, the sugars would keep for years. It is said that our people learned to make sugar from the squirrels. In late winter, the hungry time, when caches of nuts are depleted, squirrels take to the treetops and gnaw on the branches of sugar maples. Scraping the bark allows sap to exude from the twig, and the squirrels drink it. But the real goods come the next morning, when they follow the same circuit they made the day before, licking up the sugar crystals that formed on the bark overnight. Freezing temperatures cause the water in the sap to sublimate, leaving a sweet, crystalline crust like rock candy behind, enough to tide them over through the hungriest time of year. Our people call this time the maple sugar moon, Zizibosquet Gizis. The month before is known as the hard crust on snow moon. People living a subsistence lifestyle also know it as the hunger moon, when stored food has dwindled and game is scarce. But the maples carried the people through, provided food just when they needed it most. They had to trust that Mother Earth would find a way to feed them, even in the depths of winter. But mothers are like that. In return, ceremonies of thanksgiving are held at the start of the sap run. The maples each year carry out their part of the original instructions, to care for the people. But they care for their own survival at the same time. The buds that sense the incipient turn of the season are hungry. For shoots that are only 1 millimeter long, to become full-fledged leaves, they need food. So when the buds sense spring, they send a hormonal signal down the trunk to the roots, a wake-up call, telegraphed from the light world to the underworld. The hormone triggers the formation of amylase, the enzyme responsible for cleaving large molecules of starch stored in the roots into small molecules of sugar. When the concentration of sugar in the roots begins to grow, it creates an osmotic gradient that draws water in from the soil. Dissolved in this water from the spring-wet earth, the sugar streams upward as rising sap to feed the buds. It takes a lot of sugar to feed people and buds, so the tree uses its sapwood, the xylem, as the conduit. Sugar transport is usually restricted to the thin layer of phloem tissue under the bark. But in spring, before there are leaves to make their own sugar, the need is so great that xylem is called into duty as well. At no other time of year does sugar move this way, only now, when it's needed. Sugar flows upstream for a few weeks in the spring, but when the buds break and leaves emerge, they start making sugar on their own, and the sapwood returns to its work as the water conduit. Because the mature leaves make more sugar than they can use right away, the sugar stream starts to flow in the opposite direction, from leaves back to roots through the phloem. And so the roots, which feed the buds, are now fed in return by the leaves all summer long. The sugar is converted back to starch, stored in the original root cellar. The syrup we pour over pancakes on a winter morning is summer sunshine, flowing in golden streams to pool on our plates. Night after night, I stayed up tending the fire, boiling our little kettle of sap. All day long, the plink, plink, plink of sap filled the buckets, and the girls and I gathered them after school to pour into the collecting can. The trees gave sap much faster than I could boil it, so we bought another garbage can to hold the excess, and then another. Eventually, we pulled the spiles from the trees to stop the flow and avoid wasting the sugars. The end result was terrible bronchitis from sleeping in a lawn chair in the driveway in March and 3 quarts of syrup, a little bit gray, with wood ash. When my daughters remember our sugaring adventure now, they roll their eyes and groan. It was so much work. They remember hauling branches to feed the fire and slopping sap on their jackets as they carried heavy buckets. They tease me about being a wretched mother who wove their connection to the land through forced labor. They were awfully little to be doing the work of a sugaring crew, but they also remember the wonder of drinking sap straight from the tree. Sap, but not syrup. Nana Bojo made certain that the work would never be too easy. His teachings remind us that one half of the truth is that the earth endows us with great gifts. The other half is that the gift is not enough. The responsibility does not lie with the maples alone. The other half belongs to us. We participate in its transformation. It is our work and our gratitude that distills the sweetness. Night after night, I sat by the fire, the girls tucked safely in bed, the rustle of the fire and the bubbling sap a lullaby. Transfixed by the fire, I hardly noticed the sky silver as the maple sugar moon rose in the east. So bright on a clear freezing night, it threw tree shadows against the house, bold black embroidery around the windows where the girls lay sleeping, the shadows of the twin trees. These two, perfectly matched in girth and form, stand centered in front of the house by the edge of the road, their shadows framing the front door, like dark columns of a maple portico. They rise in unison without a branch until they reach the roof line, where they spread like an umbrella. They grew up with this house, shaped by its protection. There was a custom in the mid-1800s of planting twin trees to celebrate a marriage and the starting of a home. The stance of these two, just 10 feet apart, recalls a couple standing together on the porch steps, holding hands. The reach of their shade links the front porch with the barn across the road, creating a shady path of back and forth for that young family. I realize that those first homesteaders were not the beneficiaries of that shade, at least not as a young couple. They must have meant for their people to stay here. Surely those two were sleeping up on Cemetery Road long before the shade arched across the road. I am living today in the shady future they imagined, drinking sap from trees planted with their wedding vows. They could not have imagined me many generations later, and yet I live in the gift of their care. Could they have imagined that when my daughter Lyndon was married, she would choose leaves of maple sugar for the wedding giveaway? Such a responsibility I have to these people and these trees left to me, an unknown come to live under the guardianship of the twins, with a bond physical, emotional, and spiritual. I have no way to pay them back. Their gift to me is far greater than I have ability to reciprocate. They're so huge as to be nearly beyond my care, although I do scatter granules of fertilizer at their feet and turn the hose on them in summer drought. Perhaps all I can do is love them. All I know to do is to leave another gift for them and for the future, those next unknowns who will live here. I heard once that Maori people make beautiful wood sculptures that they carry long distances into the forest and leave them there as a gift to the trees. And so I plant daffodils, hundreds of them, in sunny flocks beneath the maples, in homage to their beauty and in reciprocity for their gift. Even now, as the sap rises, so too the daffodils rise underfoot. Witch Hazel, as told through the eyes of my daughter. November is not a time for flowers. The day is short and cold. Heavy clouds drag at my mood, and sleet, like a muttered curse, propels me indoors. I'm reluctant to venture out again. So when the sun breaks through for that rare yellow day, maybe the last before the snow falls, I have to go. Because the woods are quiet this time of year, without leaves or birds, the buzz of a bee seems inordinately loud. Intrigued, I follow her path. What could bring her out in November? She makes directly for bare branches, which, when I look more closely, are strewn with yellow flowers. Witch Hazel. The flowers are a ragged affair, five long petals, each like a scrap of fading yellow cloth that snagged on the branch, torn strips that wave in the breeze. But oh, are they welcome, a spot of color when months of gray lie ahead, a last hurrah before winter that suddenly reminds me of a November long ago. The house had stood empty since she left. The cardboard Santas she had pasted on the tall windows were faded from shafts of summer sun, and plastic poinsettias on the table were draped in cobwebs. You could smell that the mice ransacked the pantry while the Christmas ham turned to mounds of mold in the icebox after the power was shut off. Outside on the porch, a wren built its nest in the lunchbox again, awaiting her return. Asters bloomed in profusion under the sagging clothesline, where a gray cardigan was still pinned. I first met Hazel Barnett when I was walking the fields in Kentucky, looking for wild blackberries with my mother. We were bent to our picking when I heard a high voice from the hedgerow call, "Howdy-do, howdy-do!" And there at the fence stood the oldest woman I'd ever seen. Slightly afraid, I took my mother's hand as we walked over to greet her. She supported herself by leaning against the fence among the pink and burgundy hollyhocks. Her iron-gray hair was drawn into a bun at the back of her neck, with a corona of white wisps standing out like sun rays around her toothless face. "I like to see your light at night," she said. "It feels real neighborly. I seen y'all out walking and come to say hi to you." My mother introduced herself, explained we'd moved in a few months ago. "And who is this little bundle of joy?" she asked, leaning over the barbed wire to pinch my cheek. The fence pressed into the loose breast of her house dress, where pink and purple flowers, like the hollyhocks, were fading from many washings. She wore bedroom slippers outside in the garden, something my mother would never allow. She stuck her wrinkled old hand over the fence, veiny and crooked, with a wire-thin band of gold loose on her ring finger. I'd never heard of a person named Hazel, but I've heard of Witch Hazel, and was quite certain that this must be the witch herself. I held my mother's hand even tighter. I suppose, given the way she is with plants, there was a time when some might have called her witch. There is something eerie about a tree that flowers so far out of season and then spits its seeds, shiny pearls as black as midnight, 20 feet into the quiet fall woods with a sound like an elfin footfall. She and my mother became unlikely friends, trading recipes and garden tips. By day, my mother was a professor at the college in town, sitting at her microscope, writing scientific articles. But spring twilight found her barefoot in the garden, planting beans and helping me fill my pail with earthworms that were severed by her shovel. I thought I could nurse them back to health in the worm hospital I constructed beneath the irises. She encouraged me in this, always saying, "There is no hurt that can't be healed by love." Before dark, many evenings, we would wander across the pasture to the fence and meet Hazel. "I do like to see your light in the window," she said. "There ain't nothing better than a good neighbor." I listened while they discussed putting stove ash at the base of tomato plants to keep off the cutworms. Or Mama bragged on how fast I was learning to read. "Lord, she's a quick study, ain't you, my little honeybee?" Hazel said. Sometimes she had a wrapped peppermint in her dress pocket for me, the cellophane old and soft around it. The visits progressed from the fence line to the front porch. When we baked, we would take over a plate of cookies and sip lemonade on her sagging stoop. I never liked to go in the house, an overwhelming jumble of old junk, trash bag, cigarette smoke, and what I now know is the smell of poverty. Hazel lived in the little shotgun house with her son Sam and daughter Janie. Janie was, as her mother explained, simple, on account of she came late in life, her mother's last child. She was kind and loving and always wanting to smother my sister and me in her deep, soft arms. Sam was disabled, couldn't work, but received some veterans' benefits and pension from the coal company that they all lived on. Barely. When he was well enough to go fishing, he would bring us big catfish from the river. He coughed like crazy, but had twinkling blue eyes and a world of stories, having been overseas in the war. Once he brought us a whole bucket of blackberries he'd picked along the railroad track. My mom tried to refuse that big pail as too generous a gift. "Why, don't talk nonsense," Hazel said. "They aren't my berries. The Lord done made these things for us to share." My mother loved to work. For her, a good time was building stone walls or clearing brush. On occasion, Hazel would come over and sit in a lawn chair under the oaks while Mama stacked stones or split kindling. They would just talk about this and that, Hazel telling about how she liked a good woodpile, especially when she used to take in washing to earn a little extra. She needed a goodly pile to fuel her wash tubs. She had worked as a cook in a place down by the river, and she shook her head at the number of platters she could carry at one time. Mama would tell her about her students or a trip she'd taken, and Hazel would wonder at the very idea of flying in an airplane. And Hazel would tell about the time she was called out to deliver a baby in a snowstorm, or how people would come to her door for healing herbs. She said how some other lady professor had once come with a tape recorder to talk to her and was going to put her in a book on account of all the old ways she knew. But the professor had never come back, and Hazel'd never seen the book. I half listened to talk about gathering hickory nuts under the big trees or carrying a lunch pail to her daddy, who worked making barrels at the distillery down by the river. But my mother was charmed by Hazel's stories. I know my mother loved being a scientist, but she always said that she was born too late. Her real calling, she was sure, was to be a 19th-century farm wife. She sang while she canned tomatoes, stewed peaches, punched down the dough for bread, and was insistent that I learn how too. When I think back on her friendship with Hazel, I suppose that the deep respect they had for each other was rooted in such things. Both were women with feet planted deep in the earth, who took pride in a back strong enough to carry a load for others. Mostly I heard their talk as a drone of grown-up chatter, but one time, when my mother was coming across the yard with a big armload of wood, I saw Hazel drop her head in her hands and cry. "When I lived at home," she said, "I could carry a load like that. Why, I could carry a bushel of peaches on one hip and a baby on the other without hardly trying. But now it's all gone. Gone with the wind." Hazel was born and raised over in Jessamine County, Kentucky, just down the road. To hear her talk, though, it might have been hundreds of miles away. She couldn't drive, nor could Janie or Sam, so her old house was as lost to her as if it lay across the Great Divide. She had come here to live with Sam when he had a heart attack on Christmas Eve. She loved Christmas, all the folks coming by, cooking a big dinner, but she dropped everything that Christmas, locked her door, came to live with her son and look after him. She hadn't been back home since, but you could see that her heart ached for the place. She would get a faraway look in her eyes when she spoke of it. My mother understood this, the longing for home. She was a northern girl, born in the shadow of the Adirondacks. She had lived lots of places for graduate school and research, but always thought she'd go back home. I remember the fall she cried for missing the blaze of red maple. She was transplanted to Kentucky by dint of a good job in my father's career, but I know she missed her own folks and the woods of home. The taste of exile was as much in her mouth as it was in Hazel's. As Hazel grew older, she got sadder and would talk more and more about the old times, the things she would never see again. How tall and handsome her husband Rowley had been. How beautiful her gardens were. My mother once offered to take her back to see her old place, but she shook her head. "Oh, that's mighty nice of you, but I couldn't be beholden like that. Anyway, it's gone with the wind," she would say. "All gone." But one fall afternoon, when the light was long and gold, she phoned up. "Now, honey, I know your hands and heart are full, but if there was any way you could see fit to drive me back to the old place, I'd be right thankful. I need to see to that roof before the snow flies." My mother and I picked her up and drove up the Nicholasville Road toward the river. It's all four-lane now, with a big span across the Kentucky River. So high, you hardly know it's flowing, muddy, below you. At the old distillery, boarded up and empty now, we left the highway and drove down a little dirt road that angles back away from the river. Hazel began to cry in the back seat the minute we made the turn. "Oh, my dear old road," she cried, and I patted her hand. I knew what to do, for I'd seen my mother cry just like this when she took me past the house where she had grown up. Hazel directed Mama past the ramshackle little houses, a few stove-in trailers, and remnants of barns. We stopped before a grassy swale under a thick grove of black locust trees. "Here it is," she said, "my home sweet home." She talked like that, like it was right out of a book. Before us was an old schoolhouse with long chapel windows set all around and two doors at the front, one for boys and one for girls. It was silvery gray with just a few swipes of whitewash blurred across the clapboard. Hazel was eager to get out, and I had to hurry to get her walker to her before she stumbled in the tall grass. Pointing all the way at the spring house, the old chicken coop, she led Mama and me to the side door and up onto the porch. She fumbled in her big purse for the keys, but her hands were shaking so badly she asked me if I would unlock the door. I opened the tattered old screen door and the key slid easily into the padlock. I held the door back for her, and she clumped inside and stopped. Just stopped and looked. It was quiet as a church. The air was cold inside and flowed out past me into the warm November afternoon. I started to go in, but my mother's hand on my arm stopped me. "Just let her be," her look said. The room before us was like a picture book about the olden days. A big old wood stove sat along the back wall. Cast iron frying pans hung alongside. Dish towels were neatly hung on dowels over the dry sink, and once white curtains framed the view of the grove outside. The ceilings were high, as befits an old schoolhouse, and festooned with garlands of tinsel, blue and silver, flickering in the breeze from the open door. Christmas cards outlined the door frames, fixed with yellowing tape. The whole kitchen was decked out for Christmas. An oilcloth of a holiday print covered the table, and plastic poinsettias swathed in cobwebs sat in jam jars as a centerpiece. The table was set for 6 places, and there was still food on the plates. The chairs pushed back, just as they were when dinner had been interrupted by the call from the hospital. "What a sight," she said. "Let's put this all to rights." Suddenly Hazel became as businesslike as if she'd just walked into her house after supper and found it below her housewifely standards. She set her walker aside and began gathering up the dishes from the long kitchen table and carrying them over to the sink. My mother tried to slow her down by asking for a tour of the place and saying we could get to tidying another time. Hazel took us into the parlor, where the skeleton of a Christmas tree stood, with a pile of needles on the floor below. The ornaments hung like orphans on the bare branches. There was a little red drum, and silver plastic birds with paint worn off, and stubs where their tails should be. It had been a cozy room. There were rocking chairs and a couch, a little spindle-leg table and gas lamps. An old oak sideboard held a china pitcher and a basin painted with roses. A hand-embroidered scarf, cross-stitched in pink and blue, ran the length of the sideboard. "My goodness," she said, wiping the corner of her house dress over the thick layer of dust. "I've got to get after my dustin' in here." While she and Mama looked at the pretty dishes and sideboard, I wandered off to explore. I pushed one door open to a big unmade bed, heaped with blankets thrown back. Beside it was what looked like a potty chair, only grown-up size. It didn't smell very good in there, and I quickly retreated, not wanting to be caught snooping around. Another door gave way to a bedroom with a beautiful patchwork quilt and more tinsel garlands draped over the mirror above the dresser where a hurricane lamp sat, all caked in soot. Hazel leaned on my mother's arm as we circled around the clearing outside, pointing out trees she had planted and flower beds long overgrown. At the back of the house, under the oaks, was a clump of bare gray branches erupting with a froth of stringy yellow blossoms. "Why, looky here, it's my old medicine come to greet me," she said, and reached out to take the branch as if she was going to shake its hand. "I made me many a batch of this old witch hazel, and folks would come to me for it special. I'd cook up that bark in the fall and have it all winter to rub on aches and pains, burns and rashes. Everybody wanted it. There ain't hardly no hurt the woods don't have medicine for." "That's witch hazel," she said. "It's not just good for you outside, but inside, too. Land sakes, flowers in November? The good Lord gave us witch hazel to remind us that there's always something good, even when it seems like there ain't. It just lightens your heavy heart, is what it does." After that first visit, Hazel would often call on a Sunday afternoon and ask, "Would y'all like to go for a ride?" My mother thought it important that we girls go along. It was like her insistence that we learn to bake bread and plant beans, things that didn't seem important then, but now I know differently. We got to pick hickory nuts from behind the old house, wrinkle our noses at the tilting outhouse, and root around in the barn for treasures while Mama and Hazel sat on the porch and talked. Hung on a nail right beside her door was an old metal black lunchbox, open and lined with what looked like shelf paper. There were remnants of a bird's nest within. Hazel had brought along a small plastic bag filled with cracker crumbs, which she scattered on the porch rail. This little Jenny Wren has made her home here ever since Rowley passed on. This here was his lunch pail. Now she counts on me for house and home, and I can't let her down. A lot of people must have counted on Hazel when she was young and strong. She took us driving down her road, and we stopped at nearly every house but one. "Them are no count folks," she said, and looked away. The others seemed overjoyed to see Hazel again. My sister and I would follow the chickens around or pet the hound dogs, while Mama and Hazel would visit with the neighbors. These folks were very different from the ones we met at school or at parties at the college. One lady reached out to tap my teeth. "Those are mighty pretty teeth you got," she said. I'd never thought that teeth were worthy of a compliment, but then I hadn't met people before who had so few. I mostly remember their kindness, though. They were ladies Hazel had sung with in the choir of the little white church under the pines, ladies she had known since girlhood, and they cackled together about dances by the river and shook their heads sadly over the fate of kids who up and moved away. We'd go home in the afternoon with a basket of fresh eggs or a slice of cake for each of us, and Hazel just beaming. When winter began, our visits were fewer, and the light seemed to go out of Hazel's eyes. She sat at our kitchen table one day and said, "I know I shouldn't ask the good Lord for nothing more than I already got, but how I wish I could have just one more Christmas in my dear old home. But those days are gone, gone with the wind." This was an ache for which the woods had no medicine. We were not going north to my grandma and grandpa's for Christmas that year, and my mother was taking it hard. It was still weeks until Christmas, but already she was baking up a fury while we girls strung popcorn and cranberries for the tree. She talked about how she would miss the snow, the smell of balsam, and her family. And then she got an idea. It was to be a complete surprise. She got the house key from Sam and went to the old schoolhouse to see what she could do. She got on the phone to the rural electric co-op and arranged to have Hazel's power reconnected, just for those few days. As soon as the lights came on, it became clear how dirty it all was. There was no running water, so we had to bring jugs of water from home to sponge things down. The job was bigger than us, so Mama enlisted the help of some fraternity boys from her classes at the college who needed a community service project. They sure got one. Cleaning out that refrigerator rivaled any microbiology experiment. We drove up and down Hazel's road, where I ran into houses with handmade invitations for all her old friends. There weren't too many, so Mama invited the college boys and her friends too. The house still had its Christmas decorations, but we made more. Paper chains and candles out of paper towel tubes. My dad cut a tree and set it up in the parlor with a box of lights stripped from the skeleton tree that had stood there before. We brought armloads of prickly red cedar boughs to decorate the tables and hung candy canes on the tree. The smell of cedar and peppermint filled the place where mold and mice had been only days ago. My mom and her friends baked plates of cookies. The morning of the party, the heat was on, the tree lights lit, and one by one, people started to arrive, clumping up the steps of the front porch. My sister and I played hostess while Mama drove off to get the guest of honor. "Hey, any of y'all feel like going for a ride?" Mama said, and bundled Hazel into her warm coat. "Well, where are we going?" Hazel asked. Her face gleamed like a candle when she stepped into her home sweet home, filled with light and friends. My mother pinned a Christmas corsage, a plastic bell with golden glitter that she had found on the dresser, to Hazel's dress. Hazel moved through her house like a queen that day. My father and my sister played their violins in the parlor, silent night and joy to the world, while I ladled out sweet red punch. I don't remember much more about the party, except Hazel falling asleep on the way home. Just a few years later, we left Kentucky to move back north. My mom was glad to be going home, to have her maples instead of oaks, but saying goodbye to Hazel was hard. She saved it for last. Hazel gave her a going-away present, a rocking chair, and a little box with a couple of her old-time Christmas ornaments inside, a celluloid drum, and a silver plastic bird missing its tail feathers. My mother still hangs them on her tree every year and tells the story of that party as if it were the best Christmas she ever had. We got word that Hazel had died a couple of years after we moved. Gone? All gone with the wind, she would have said. There are some aches which Hazel can't assuage. For those, we need each other. My mother and Hazel Barnett, unlikely sisters, I suppose, learned well from the plants they both loved. They made a balm for loneliness together, a strengthening tea for the pain of longing. Now, when the red leaves are all down and the geese are gone, I go looking for Witch Hazel. It never lets me down, always carrying the memory of that Christmas and how their friendship was medicine for each other. I cherish a Witch Hazel kind of day, a scrap of color, a light in the window when winter is closing all around. A Mother's Work. I wanted to be a good mother, that's all. Like Sky Woman, maybe. Somehow this led me into hip waders, filled with brown water. The rubber boots that were intended to keep the pond at bay now contain it. And me. And one tadpole. I feel a flutter at the back of my other knee. Make that two tadpoles. When I left Kentucky to go house hunting in upstate New York, my two small daughters gave me an explicit wish list for our new home. Trees big enough for tree forts, one apiece. A stone walk lined with pansies, like the one in Larkin's favorite book. A red barn, a pond to swim in, a purple bedroom. The last request gave me some comfort. Their dad had just pulled up stakes, left the country, and us. He said that he no longer wanted a life with so much responsibility. So the responsibility was all mine. I was grateful that if nothing else, I could at least paint a bedroom purple. All winter long I looked at house after house, none of which made sense for either my budget or my hopes. Real estate listings, three bedrooms, two bath, raised ranch, landscaping, are pretty thin on vital information like trees suitable for tree houses. I confess I was thinking more about mortgages and school districts and whether I was going to end up in a trailer park at the end of the road. But the girl's wish list surfaced in my mind when the agent drove me to an old farmhouse surrounded by immense sugar maples, two with low spreading branches, perfect for tree houses. This was a possibility. But there was the matter of sagging shutters and a porch that hadn't seen level in half a century. On the plus side, it sat on 7 acres, including what was described as a trout pond, which was only a smooth expanse of ice surrounded by trees at the time. The house was empty, cold and unloved, but as I opened doors to the musty rooms, wonder of wonders, the corner bedroom was the color of spring violets. It was a sign. This is where we would fall to earth. We moved in that spring. And not long after, the girls and I cobbled together tree forts in the maples, one apiece. Imagine our surprise when the snow melted to reveal a flagstone walk overgrown with weeds leading to the front door. We met the neighbors, explored the hilltops with picnic luncheons, planted pansies, and started to put down the roots of happiness. Being the good mother, good enough for two parents, seemed within my grasp. All that remained was to complete the wish list for home was a swimmable pond. The deed described a deep spring-fed pond, and 100 years ago it might have been exactly that. One of my neighbors, whose family has been here for generations, told me that it was the favorite pond in the valley. In summer, after haying, the boys would park their wagons and hike up to the pond for a swim. We'd throw off our clothes and jump in, he said, The way it sits, no girls would be able to see us, buck naked as we were. And cold? That spring kept the water icy cold, and it felt so good after working hay. We'd lie in the grass afterward just to warm up. Our pond nestles in the hill up behind the house. The slopes rise around it on three sides, and a copse of apple trees on the other entirely shield it from view. At its back is a limestone cliff where rock was quarried to build my house more than 200 years ago. It was hard to believe that anyone would dip even a toe in that pond today. My daughter certainly would not. It was so choked with green that you could not tell where the weeds left off and the water began. The ducks didn't help. If anything, they were what you might politely call a major source of nutrient input. They were so cute in the feed store. Just downy yellow fluff connecting outsized beaks and enormous orange feet, waddling around in a crate of wood chips. It was almost spring, almost Easter, all the good reasons not to take them home evaporated with the girls' delight. Wouldn't a good mother adopt ducklings? Isn't that what a pond is for? We kept them in a cardboard box in the garage with a heat lamp, closely watched so neither box nor ducklings would ignite. The girls accepted full responsibility for their care and dutifully fed and cleaned them. I came home from work one afternoon to see them floating in the kitchen sink, quacking and dabbling, shaking water off their backs while the girls just beamed. The condition of the sink should have given me a clue of what was to come. For the next few weeks, they ate and defecated with equal enthusiasm. But within a month, we carried the box of 6 glossy white ducks up to the pond and released them. They preened and splashed. All was well for the first few days, but apparently in the absence of their own good mother to protect and teach them, they didn't have the essential survival skills for life